Welcome to the Beef Wash Podcast. I'm Aaron Berger, a Nebraska Extension educator. For today's Beef Wash Podcast, we're going to discuss some research that's been done by Dr. Brandon Smith when he was part of his master's program there at the University of Arkansas, looking at limit feeding soy holes with some low quality hay. But before we dive into our conversation today about that topic and his research, Dr. Smith, thanks for joining me, and it'd be good to just hear a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on, Aaron. So I'm originally from Alabama. Like you said, my name is Brandon Smith, originally from Alabama. Did my undergraduate degrees here at Auburn, went on for my master's degree at University of Arkansas, and that's where you came across my work. Finished up my education at Texas A&M, and then for the past 10 years, I've been a faculty member. So I did the first half of that at Tarleton State University in more of a teaching role, and then moved on to Auburn in more of a research role, but still always addressing ruminant nutrition and forage agronomy. So my degrees went back and forth. I never could decide which side of that fence I wanted to land on, so I just didn't.
So talk about some of the broad overwork of the things you're doing there at Auburn. You're focused on forage systems, specifically related to ruminant nutrition. Just kind of give us a brief overview of some of the things you're working on today.
Sure. So today, like you said, it's ruminant nutrition and forage systems. So I've put my research into several different buckets. On the ruminant nutrition side, I still work very heavily in the supplementation area. My background in that was always in looking at the production aspect, and I'm keeping that aspect. But the more that I develop students in that area, I'm trying to dive a little deeper into the rumen metabolism, rumen physiology of what's happening there, trying to get a better idea of dialing in those supplementation programs. And then on the forage side of things, looking at what forage combinations work for specific systems, especially as we get more sporadic, or I guess I would say more erratic, not sporadic, but erratic weather patterns. What forage systems work in those? You know, are we getting warmer? Are we getting more seasonal rainfall? Do we need to add different forages to those systems? And how all of those fit together at a systems level approach.
So tell us a little more about the research that you did there at Arkansas as part of your master's program. What was the question you were seeking to get answered?
The question that I was trying to answer is actually extremely relevant today. And it's amazing to me that it kind of goes in this 10, 15 year cycle where we see some of these same issues pop back up. I started my degree there at Arkansas in 2012. We had just come out of a horrible drought cycle in 2011. This was really and has been influential and foundational in shaping how I approach research today. This was truly a boots on the ground led research project. One of our research stations there in Arkansas, coming out of that drought, was short on hay. They had produced none out of their hay fields in the past season. So the question was, how are we going to get the cows through this next cycle? We were coming out of it. It was still a little dry in 2012. What are we going to do? They were having to ship hay in. The cost of shipping that hay in was really putting it in the realm of, you know, the cost benefit was not weighing out. There were some emergency measures. They were able to get some hay off CRP land. But as we all know, when you start getting into emergency measures and hay off of those lands, the quality is not necessarily there. You've got the rumen fill. You're providing some dry matter to the animal, but the quality of support of that animal is not there. So we were approaching, how can we help the center out? How can we help our own center, our own station, make it through this time? And we started looking back at some of the work that had been done about 10, 15, 20 years before that out of the Midwest on limit feeding. Could you limit feed these animals and get them through? They were looking at it from a little different perspective. They were looking at it more on the growing animal. But the question was, could you do this with gestating animals? And very thankfully, the answer was yes.
So talk a little about soy holes, because I think probably many folks are familiar with what those are. But just talk about the nutritional qualities of those and why they work with low quality forage.
Sure. So soy holes in particular fit that system because at the time, very affordable. And, you know, feed markets go up and down over the year. So if we listen to this podcast next year, then this may be totally out of the realm of possibility. But as we go in waves of those byproduct feeds, what I really like about soy holes is You get a moderate level of protein. So the protein, we're not talking about the type of protein that's going to be a soybean meal, of course. We're not taking the endosperm out of that. We're dealing with the outer seed coat. So I would call it moderate protein, but you're also getting digestible fiber. And the combination of those two mean that you're really not shifting a nutrition program away from that forage and fiber-based system. And that's where sometimes in our supplementation and feeding programs, we can get in trouble when you take something that's very dense in starch or very dense in protein, you shift the rumen ecology over, and it's almost a shock to the system. Soy hulls in particular, and I would put those in the same category as something like distillers grains or some of the cotton byproducts, really work in that system because they don't shift that rumen ecology away from its natural state.
So talk just briefly about where do soy hulls come from? I mean, I think for most folks they may recognize that, but just understanding the makeup of that I think is important as we think about how this is used with the research you did.
Sure, I 100% agree with that. So the soy hull itself is going to be the outer layer, the seed coat or almost shell, if you will, of the soybean. So it's not the shell as in the pod, just the outer coating of the bean itself. And we get this from processing soybeans for oil. So the main product out of the soybean is going to be the soybean oil. From that, we have soybean meal, which is the dried remaining portions. The hull, so seed coat, is going to come from that. And then the amount of soy hulls that are generated are going to depend on what type of soybean meal was being produced. So you can adjust the standardized protein in soybean meal by how much hull is added back into that system. Soy hulls themselves then come off. You can have them loose, or in the past 10 years or so, I've seen more use of them as pelleted.
So we've talked about the protein content that is moderate on soy hulls, somewhere in that 10, 11, 12% crude protein area. Let's talk about the energy value. How does that figure into what we're thinking about in terms of what energy does soy hulls bring to a diet?
On a TDN basis, soy hulls were going to be in that 70 to 75% range, somewhere thereabouts. So, to put that in perspective, we generally look at hay. Now, this, of course, hay is going to be all over the board, but hay we generally think of as that 50 to 55% range being the floor of what you need for maintenance. So, we're looking at something that I would call halfway between a forage, so a hay, versus a concentrate, like if you were feeding cracked corn or something like that.
But as you said earlier, one of the advantages of these soy hulls is that they're a fiber-based energy source. So if we're thinking about a cow on a low-quality forage diet, she might get some more benefit from a fiber-based energy source than she would from a starch-based energy source like corn. Is that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And not even that, but as we look at these soy hulls, all fiber is not created equal. If they're on a pasture-based system or a hay system, they're getting plenty of the physically effective fiber, the scratch factor, long stem type fiber. Soy hulls offer us that unique aspect of digestible fiber. So it's chemical fiber. It chemically makes up fiber, but the digestibility is higher, which is where you get that higher TDN. That's what really benefits the system. And where you were going with the using a fiber-based energy source over something like a starch-based, it meshes very well.
So let's get back to your research study that you set up. So we're dealing with a situation where the research center was low on hay. They've got some cows they need to get through the fall and winter before they've got additional growth. They're looking at, some kind of low quality hay. I think the research, if I remember correctly, it was a CRP type hay. So pretty low quality. Set up for us the study you did and how you compared that to the alternative.
Absolutely. And so, like you were introducing, and I was saying, very, very production-oriented study. And we set this up almost as a producer-led event. So, taking our gestating cows, so these cows would have been late second trimester, early third trimester, getting them through the wintertime. And we set them up in two different treatments. In these, the ones that were on the pasture only, so the business as usual, if you will, got some pretty decent quality. I would on the edge of good quality, let's go with good quality, Bermuda grass hay. The downside of that is we had to ship it in from Mississippi. So trucking cost at the time, I want to say we were somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 a loaded mile. And, of course, we would love to have that type of number today. But at the time, that was still putting us in the realm of that hay was costing more than it was worth nutritionally. Other half of the animals, we took that low quality, very, very poor quality CRP hay, set it in the field, put an electric fence around it, and limited their access. So we did some back of the envelope calculations on how much should they consume a day, and what we came up with was let's give them an hour's access. If we can give them an hour's access, that was going to be just enough for them to get a good couple of mouthfuls of that hay, get the scratch factor, but not use that as their primary source of nutrition, then come back and work on meeting the rest of their maintenance requirement from those soybean hulls. So we were getting them up to maintenance with the additional feed. As we pulled all of that together, we really ended up with some very interesting results out of that. So not only did the system work, but we were able to tie in some really cool things on that. One of the things that was interesting about this system is, one, our calculations of what their maintenance requirements were wrong. And not wrong on purpose, wrong because of the actual physiology of what's happened. One thing that we don't tend to, especially on those back of the envelope calculations, take into account is there's an energy demand for the amount of material that's sitting in the gut at any given time. So the animals that were on that hay-based diet had a lot of material sitting in the gut at any given time that was contributing to their energy demand. The ones that had restricted access to hay first ate more hay than we gave them credit for. I'm very impressed by how much a cow can eat when you only give them an hour's access and they start to get trained to that. But because the gut feel was so much lower, the amount that was being consumed on a daily basis so much lower, the maintenance requirement of those animals came down because there was not that demand of trying to expend energy in the gut itself. So the animals actually ended up gaining a little bit of weight relative to those control animals.
So talk about that a little bit more, because I think for some folks they're thinking, what do you mean by that? The cow that eats more has higher requirements? How can that be?
It baffled me to begin with, too. I'll be totally honest with you. And it's one of those things that honestly is very, very counterintuitive. But if we kind of come back to basics, come back to the basic biology of it, think of yourself after you've eaten a big meal. Well, let's say that you sleep in a little bit on the weekend, you get up and have a pretty big brunch, and that's when, or take your Thanksgiving meal, you pig out at lunchtime, you want to go down and take a nap. Why is it that you want to go take a nap? And some people say it's tryptophan, some say it's this and that, and it is a combination of things. But part of it is you've now added an enormous amount of material into your gut, and the gut has now put the energy demand on the body. So the gut now is saying, I need energy because I've got to produce enzymes, because I've got to increase motility to move this material through the system. And so, again, counterintuitive, but adding more material to the gut increases the amount of energy needed to process it. So it goes back to some of the economics lessons that we think of. You have to have some money to make some money. All right, same thing there. You have to have a little energy to then get the energy out of the feed that's being consumed.
Oh, I think that makes a lot of sense. I guess now tell us about the limit feeding these cows. Were these cows on round bale feeders, or how was it presented to them? And how did you effectively manage this 1 hour grazed, or I shouldn't say graze time, 1 hour feeding time?
They were on round bale feeders. Again, like I said, they were electric fenced off of these. The management was very manual at the time. So, we're talking 2012, 2013. So at this time, it was go through, and as we're feeding the soy hulls, go ahead and open up the fence. They're going to go into the hay because they've been standing there waiting on it this whole time. As you go through, it timed out about right that you open those fences up. You go load up the buckets for the soy hulls. By the time you come back, it's time to push them out of that fenced off area, close off the hay, and go ahead and feed those buckets of soy hulls. And so it was a lot of manual management at that time. Now, I will say in that amount of time, we've had a lot of innovation and some things like, well, some of the improved electric fencing technologies, or even some of these technologies like virtual fencing and things like that, may actually help on some of that matter.
But I think the simplicity of what you just shared, though, is something that, and you said this was very producer driven. A producer could do this. You could go out at 5:30, open the gate, let the cows out on the hay, go get your soy holes, put it in the bunk, and draw them off and be to work by 8.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was like we've been talking about this whole producer-oriented research. We were trying to help them out, but we also couldn't interrupt the overall business of the center. And so that was really what drove the system was it didn't change the operations of the center. It was we open that gate, go fill up the buckets, come shut the gate, really didn't change overall operations. We, again, like you said, the beauty of it made it work.
So talk about, you said these cows consumed more than you would have thought in an hour's time on this hay. How much were they eating?
So on this one, we did not measure direct dry matter intake. So I'll go ahead and couch that we did not directly measure it. What we did do was we came through and just looked at hay disappearance. So how many bales were being removed at any given time. On the ones that were getting limit-fed soy hulls, restricted soy hulls, we were on a 6 kilogram a day intake. So that's somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1% of their body weight, which we only credited them. We thought they would consume maybe a quarter to a half percent. They doubled what we thought they could do in an hour.
So they were getting essentially somewhere around 10, 12 pounds of hay. Is that accurate?
Yes, they were in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 pounds of hay.
Okay. So they were able, you were able to crank down and limit feed the amount of hay they were getting just with 1 hour access to somewhere in that 10 to 12 pounds as fed.
Yes, 10 to 12 pounds a day, we were able to drop that down in the hour. And like I said, that was still double what we were hoping, giving them credit for. So, in an implementation system today, if I were going to put this in, I may even think about dropping that hour back a little bit.
Okay.
I think you could probably get away with that. The good
Okay.
thing is, when we compare those to the ones that had the medium quality, good quality hay, and that was the nutritional basis, they were in that 25 to 30 pounds a day range. So we definitely trimmed it back.
But I think it also just does point out that these cows can consume a lot in a short period of time.
Yes, they can. Yes, they can. They will surprise you.
So let's go back to now the soy hole part. These were being fed in the bunk. I think they were loose holes, if I remember your research correctly. What did that look like, and how did you set up the ration there with the soy holes?
On that one, I mean, like I said, we were very back of the envelope type calculations. It was what is the maintenance required of the animal? We had to make those initial assumptions on how much hay we thought they would consume. And from there, it was what was the standard book value of soy hulls? Now, I will tell you, as a nutritionist, going on book values is dangerous, but I will also tell you, in a practical world, that's kind of what you have. By the time you have your shipment in hand, it's sometimes too late to get that test. Always recommend testing the piece of testing the hay. Sometimes it doesn't work out on the timeline. And so you have to do what you have to do. We were feeding loose hulls, and so we calculated about how much they should be able to eat to meet the maintenance requirement and offered that as a pasture average on a daily basis. So we were not doing individual feeding of these animals. It was for however many animals were in the pasture, what is the average consumption? And that was what we delivered. So overall, they ended up eating about the same amount of soy hulls as they did that low quality CRP hay, somewhere in that 10 to 12 pounds a day range.
And how was that delivered? Was it delivered into bunks? Was it delivered on the ground? How was it being fed to those cows?
We delivered it in bunks, and we didn't get very fancy with it. It was your standard plastic metal framed bunk right by the fence line.
So I guess you had the bunk set up, the cows were on the hay, you bring the buckets, you delivered the soy holes, and did the cows come to it right away then, or did you have to go bring them off the hay bales?
Initially, they came right to it. It's kind of one of those, as soon as you shake the feed bucket, they tend to decide that this is where I want to go. But over time, as I started getting more acclimated to what we were doing, understanding that they were not going to have hay access for as long as they might naturally like, It started becoming where you had to go in and push them out of the hay, push them over to the feed. Not that they disliked it. It was just one of those conditioned responses of, I've only got so much time in front of this bale.
So the soy hulls are notorious for swelling when you feed that kind of level. Did you have any bloat issues with these cows?
We did not. I was very impressed because we did know that that was a risk. Very impressed that we did not have any health issues through this study. And because of that concern, we did some companion work on campus with some fistulated animals, looking, diving a little deeper into the physiology. We did see some bloat potential there, and we were tracking that. But in the production setting, looking at these animals on pasture, we really didn't see any of that.
So you said on pasture, I assume really though that there was not much there. Their really dry matter intake came from the soy hulls and from the hay. Is that correct?
It is, and I need to correct myself. We were on dormant Bermuda grass. We chose not to go to the fescue pasture, so I need to correct myself there.
Okay, okay.
But we were on dormant Bermuda grass pasture. So yes, what they were getting was what we provided. They may have taken some mouthfuls of that dormant Bermuda grass, but it was not really supporting production.
Talk a little more about just the balancing the ration here. So I'm thinking about this low quality CRP hay. What was the energy protein there?
Energy on that CRP hay, we were at 1.7 megacals per kilogram. So you convert that over, and let's do this conversion real quick. That's going to put you somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 45% TDN. So really low. I mean, understandably below what the need would be to support that animal.
And as we think about the protein content, I'm sure it was low as well. Where did that rank?
Protein on that one was hovering at 3%.
All right. So a little better than wood chips, but not a lot.
Not a whole lot. My comparison the whole time I was in school was that I think we might have gotten a little more benefit out of cardboard.
So this is a low quality hay. And we think about CRP hay in Nebraska or corn residue, it's or wheat straw, it's going to be every bit as good as what you were feeding in this scenario, or a little better.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In my entire career, I have yet to find a forage sample that's come back that had a worse profile than this. And I'm thankful for that. I'm hoping that I go the rest of my career and don't find one that tests lower than this one did.
But I think it does illustrate and highlight this was very low quality hay. So this was a highly lignified, pretty low quality stuff, and the cows were willing to eat it, and you had the soy hulls, and they seemed to perform okay.
They did, and they did. And you bring a good point on the lignification. We were running 6% lignin, and that was compared to 3% in the Bermuda grass hay that came in from Mississippi. We were 10% higher in NDF, over 10% higher in ADF. So, yes, I mean, in terms of cell wall content, just overall stemmy, low quality, that was about as lignified as you could get.
I guess, do you think part of the reason you got along so well, and I know this is speculative, but got along so well with these cows at 10, 12 pounds of soy hulls was how low quality of hay they were eating?
I really do. I really do. I think that low quality hay, nutritionally, I don't think it was contributing very much. And like you said, we're speculating. We didn't tease out all of these different things, but I don't think it's contributing much nutritionally. I think it was keeping rumen function. I think the scratch factor was there. I think it was giving some longer term energy, keeping the cellulitic populations happy. Most of the response to the animal was coming from the soy hulls. And having that long stem factor that was kind of slowing digestion a little bit probably helped us out when it came to the bloat potential that you and I talked about earlier.
Yeah. Do you think it also helped in terms of getting the energy that's in those soy hulls out of them? Because I guess I've looked at some other data that would say if rate of passage is very high with soy hulls, we may not be capturing it all before it goes out the back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the ever-present question over rumen nutrition: do we want quality or quantity? Do we want passage or digestion? So, in this case, the fact that we did slow passage down may have been one of those benefits, and it's again one of those counterintuitive processes where normally we don't want to slow passage down because that means that we're losing some type of quality somewhere.
What did you provide in terms of supplement? I'm thinking here salt, mineral, in addition to the soy holes.
On that one, we did our standard practice, so loose trace mineralized salt that we would put out on the pasture.
So there was not any rumensin provided in this study. This was just soy holes and this low quality hay and free choice mineral.
Yes, sir. Just yeah, standard beef cow practice on that. We weren't using any growth promoting technologies.
As you monitored these cows through the time you were feeding them, were they discontent? I mean, I think as we think about this, they were getting close to 25 pounds of feed as fed, so a bit less than maybe what they would have been on the good quality Bermuda grass hay, but not were they discontent, I guess, or what was the observation of the cattle themselves and behavior?
Not really. The only discontentment was getting run out of the hay ring each day. You know, that they didn't have free access to it. It was not necessarily what we would think of as nutritional discontentment, where, you know, it's hunger. This was more behavioral discontentment. This was, you know, you're not letting me do what I want to do. Less
Right.
of hungry and you're keeping me away. We really didn't see any of that type of behavior.
So these cows were in the last trimester. I guess tell them about how long was the project itself? How long were these cows on the limit fed hay and soy holes?
We took them 70 days over the winter.
Okay.
So
Okay.
70 days over the winter pretty much took us through the majority of the time in that part of the state that we would have had no grass whatsoever. Limped us through until we could get some annual forage up, until we could get some green up on some of the other things. So got us over that bridge period.
Okay. So talk about cow performance. I guess this would have ended before calving started then. How did these cows do after calving, and how did those compare to the ones that were on free choice hay?
That was probably our biggest concern of the whole process, and one that we scratched our heads and lost a little sleep over before we started was even if we could meet the biological needs, if we could get the animals through and meet their maintenance requirements, the concern was, what are we going to do to that calf? Are we going to hamper either the calf that's on the ground, or are we going to end up holding her where the postpartum interval is going to extend? She's not going to breed back as easy. And again, pleasantly surprised when we tested all of the different measures. The body condition stayed the same for both of the animals, so none of them lost condition. They stayed in the same condition, stayed the same body weight, didn't have any dystocia issues. They didn't really lose body condition at calving. The calf birth weight, they both hit the ground at the same body weight. They weaned off at the same age, so we didn't slow the calf down. And when it came to the rebreeding interval, numerically they were off by about 5 days, but there was enough variation in the crowd that we didn't see anything. So we didn't hurt the calf that came out during that cycle, and we didn't keep her from getting pregnant and calving the next round.
As you think back on the research, any kind of take homes from a producer perspective that you'd want folks to think about or consider if they might be looking at doing something like this?
Sure. I mean, as I look back on this, at the time I thought it was pretty extreme. I thought we were taking an extreme approach, and I would say that as you're doing that's kind of the thought process I have in mind, is you are kind of pushing the boundaries, and so you want to be cautious as you do that. But as long as you're weighing the pros and cons, as long as you're thinking about, would I have done this same experiment with cracked corn? You know, one example that we've used earlier, probably not. I think I would be setting myself up for a disaster at that point. But if I'm using a byproduct that fits this system, that fits my management style, like we've talked about, that I can open up the hay, go fill up the feed buckets, shut them out of the hay when I come back. If it fits the management style and makes biological sense, I would say go for it. But those are the kind of cautions that I think should come to somebody's mind as they're contemplating this. And of course, you know, these are not things that in a good year we're probably thinking about. Even though we could, they're good production measures, we usually don't come to these type of thoughts until we're in a year where we're having to have thought.
Dr. Smith, I really appreciate the conversation with you today. Again, I think this data, as you said, we go in cycles and it sure has application for us in the upper Midwest, especially Nebraska, Colorado, Kansas, South Dakota, the western part of those states where we are dealing with extreme drought. Forage is going to be very expensive and even low quality forage is going to be challenging to find. And so some of these concentrates that are fiber-based sources, distillers grains, soy hull pellets, may offer the opportunity to do some limit feeding where we got to haul these quite a ways. And if we're hauling a product, we want to be hauling as much protein and energy as we can. And so I think a very applicable research project that I think could have a lot of value for producers this year as they think about what their options are.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, Aaron.
Well, for more information on the topic we talked about in today's Beef Wash podcast, if you'd like to visit with Dr. Brandon Smith, again, he's at the University of Auburn. He's in the Animal Science Department there, and you can find his contact information online.